VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
And we thank you for joining us on Crosstalk, coming your way from VCY America. Ladies and gentlemen, in Genesis chapter 12, Scripture says this: Now the Lord had said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Indeed, in 1948, that nation came about, and now Israel is celebrating her 75th birthday. Did you know that the very existence of Israel has been called a miracle, a country that should never be? And yet, with so many enemies surrounding her and so many threats and so many attempts to destroy her, yet Israel remains. And ladies and gentlemen, please know this nation will continue to remain. Yes, the very existence of Israel is a miracle, and today we're going to recount the circumstances that led to the formation of this nation, now celebrating 75 years. Joining us today, we welcome back Chris Katulka, the Assistant Director of North American Ministries at the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, host of the Friends of Israel Today radio broadcast. He's a Bible teacher, a writer for Israel My Glory magazine, and also author of the book Israel Always. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Jim, always a joy to be with you.
Chris, a question that many minds are trying to process right now is, why is Israel celebrating her birthday like yesterday, a big celebration? I mean, we look at history, we see that Israel became a nation on May 14th, 1948. So help us understand this discrepancy.
Of why it's today and not May 14th, 1948, there's a discrepancy because they actually connect it to the Hebrew calendar, not to the Gregorian calendar that we use. And so the celebration of Israel's Independence Day, the way they honor the Memorial Day, which happens just the day before, and then also about a week earlier or so is Holocaust Remembrance. All of those fluctuate with the Hebrew calendar and not with the calendar that we use, the Gregorian calendar. And so that's why the dates fluctuate around May 14th. May 14th is the day it actually happened, but they connect it to the Hebrew calendar, the one that starts the new year on Rosh Hashanah.
Now, so Israel's Independence Day, you mentioned, is one day after Memorial Day, and I understand more than 24,000 soldiers have died since its inception in 1948?
Yeah, exactly. So it's actually very beautiful what Israel does. They actually start the entire season leading up to an Independence Day with actually a Holocaust remembrance that happens about a week earlier, where the whole nation remembers the Holocaust and those who had passed, all of that happening before the State of Israel was founded. And then they, about a day before Independence Day, they have their Memorial Day. All of those who gave their life to provide the freedom, they served in the Israeli Defense Forces or in numerous ways of volunteering for the country. Maybe even they served as politicians. They'd be buried on what's called Herzl Mountain, Mount Herzl, which is essentially their Arlington National Cemetery, which is actually on the same mountain as Yad Vashem, which is where Israel's Holocaust Memorial is. And so, again, a beautiful picture, like I said, of honoring those who had passed in the Holocaust and then giving way to Memorial Day, those who gave their lives to secure the freedoms that Israelis have today. And then finally, like yesterday, they celebrated 75 years since statehood, all of that leading up to Israel's independence. And yes, about 24,000 Israelis gave their lives to protect the freedoms that they have as really the only democratic country in the Middle East. And I was actually just reading an article, Jim, that talked about the fact that not only did Jewish Israelis, thousands of them, give their lives in protection of their state, serving their state, but even minorities like Muslims are honored on Memorial Day who served with the IDF and perished in service. The Druze Several hundred Druze had perished, and Christians as well. So it's not just something for the majority of Jewish people. They also honor and remember those of any religion. As long as you're an Israeli, you are remembered on Memorial Day.
Hmm. And also foundational for our interview today, just describe for our listeners the size of Israel, how big this nation is, what is the population of Israel as we know her today?
You know, Israel is only the size of the state of New Jersey, and I live in New Jersey, and I can tell you it's a small state. It's about anywhere from 8.5 to 9 million people live in Israel. About 7.2 to 7.5 million of them are Jewish, and the rest would be either Muslim or Christian. The vast majority are Jewish. It has become the largest Jewish population in the world. Second to that is the United States, which also has about 7 million Jewish people that live here. And the majority of those Jewish people live in the Northeast, where I am, between Washington, D.C. and Boston. But all that to say, about 7.5 million Jewish people, give or take, live in the state of Israel. It's a very small state. The joke is you can wake up in the morning and go skiing on Mount Hermon in the north, and then by the evening, after you've skied down the mountain and traveled 5 hours south, you can be swimming with the dolphins in the Red Sea.
My.
And so it really shows you in about a five-hour stretch, and most of that is going through the Negev Desert, you can go from Israel's north to the south. And then really, it's only a handful of miles between the Mediterranean and the border between Israel and Jordan. And so it's a very small state.
With us today is Chris Katulka, who is with Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, and talking about Israel celebrating her 75th birthday. So, Chris, we no doubt have people listening right now that can remember back to that date of 1948. It does predate my time. But take us back in history, if you would, to know and understand some of these events that brought about the birth of this nation. And in doing so, introduce us to some of the key people, David Ben-Gurion and others.
Yeah, you know, I think, of course, we have to say that Jewish people, Jim, have been longing to return to their ancient homeland for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
Since they were kicked out in 135 AD, 70 AD is when Titus destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. Eventually, Jewish people came back in, but by 135 AD, under Hadrian, Emperor Hadrian, a second revolt happened, and he completely banished the Jewish people. He renamed Israel, or Judea at that time. He renamed it Palestinia, so that's where actually the name Palestine comes from. Hadrian was trying to connect it to the Philistines, Israel's enemy, and then he also got rid of the name Jerusalem and turned it into a city called Aelia Capitolina, and so tried to remove all of the Jewishness of it. And since then, Jewish people have been praying to return to their ancient homeland. So we can't forget those prayers, Jim, of Jewish people that have been praying for years and years and years and years. And Jewish people had attempted to return over the centuries. There's no doubt about that. But ultimately, there's one man that changed the tide of how all of that we see today, and it was Israel. He changed the course of history, really, by taking those prayers and putting feet to those prayers for the Jewish people. His name was Theodor Herzl. And Theodor Herzl is known as the father of modern Zionism. Zionism is both a political and a biblical term. It's biblical because the Jewish people have a right to their ancient homeland, just like you read in Genesis chapter 12 in the beginning of the program. It's biblical. It's biblical because I believe the entire Bible is a very Zionist Bible. It's talking about the land of Israel and how God gave it to the Jewish people. But then it's also a political movement to believe you're a Zionist. If your listeners are listening right now and they believe that the Jewish people have a right to live in their ancient homeland in Israel, whatever the territorial boundaries are, Jim, you don't have to believe it has to be the whole thing. Even if you believe it's a tiny little nugget of space, you know, and you believe Jewish people have a right to live there, you're still called a Zionist. And so that's Zionism. And Theodor Herzl founded that because he saw the anti-Semitism that was building in Europe where actually the vast majority of Jewish people had lived in the late 1800s. And Theodor Herzl was the one who said, you know what, I thought for certain if we just adopted our country's philosophies and the way that they think and the way that they act and we stopped being Jewish, that's what Theodor Herzl thought. He thought if we just started acting like Germans, then the Germans would like us. They wouldn't hate us anymore. If we started acting like the French would like us, and they wouldn't hate us anymore. Well, his assimilation philosophy actually was challenged when he was, as a journalist, went and took on a job where he was writing about what was called the Dreyfus Affair, where essentially this Captain Dreyfus of the French military was being charged with treason, but he was being treated with anti-Semitism. He was innocent. And when Theodor Herzl came outside after the trial, he'd see people with signs saying death to the Jews. And that's when Theodor Herzl knew Europe isn't going to help the Jewish people. Jewish people can't protect themselves. And so he decided we need a movement to establish a homeland of ourselves so Jewish people can protect themselves and we don't have to rely on a country that could easily turn their back on us. Theodor Herzl was kind of a, I mean this in a non-biblical sense, but he was a prophet. He saw the Holocaust coming. Germany would end up turning their back on the Jewish people in the 1920s and 1930s and 40s, to the tune of 6 million Jewish people being systematically murdered. But Theodor Herzl actually became the founder of modern Zionism, and he created what was called the First Zionist Congress, where Jewish people and Christians got together from all around the world. They met in Basel, Switzerland, in the late 1800s, and that's where they met and said, we need to come up with a plan to establish a Jewish state, a state where we can have our own identity, where Jewish people can protect Jewish people. That's what essentially the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, is all about. And so we can defend our own people. We don't have to rely on the United States. We don't have to rely on Germany or any European country or anywhere in the world. And so that was really the essence of what Theodor Herzl was trying to get at. And it was in the late 1800s when Theodor Herzl ended up writing in his journal that he said, you know, in 5 years, the idea of there being a Jewish state, people would laugh at me if they thought there'd be a Jewish state in 5 years. But he said, certainly in 50 years, there will be a Jewish state. That was 1897.
Oh my.
It would be 50 years from that date from about that time in 1897, that in 1947, the UN would approve the partition plan for there to be a Jewish state. Theodor Herzl almost predicted to the day of when the Jewish people were permitted to have their own state. And for that reason, Theodor Herzl he's the George Washington of the state of Israel. Hmm. And those are kind of the backdrops of how we end up with a Jewish state. A lot of people, Jim, will go, oh, the Holocaust helped create the Jewish state. It's just not true. The Holocaust definitely created the sympathies to help create the state of Israel. But we're talking about men like Theodor Herzl, David Ben-Gurion, Chaim Weizmann, even men like Albert Einstein, who believed that there needed to be a Jewish state. Jewish people all around the world working for this moment. It wasn't just the Holocaust, Jim. Jewish people have been planning for this for a very long time and praying for it.
We're going to take a quick break here. We're speaking with Chris Katulka today, who is taking us back in history to the formation of Israel and the circumstances bringing her to that nation status, now celebrating 75 years. Back in a minute here on Crosstalk.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, geologist with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, if sedimentary rock is made up of sediments deposited by Noah's flood, where did the sediments come from?
Chris, it appears that before the flood, calcareous ooze made of tiny marine animals and secretions accumulated on the ocean bottom. Scooped up by the flood, they became today's limestone deposits. It also appears that the sandstone deposits came from created granitic rock, which eroded to yield the sand that are modern-day sandstones. Also, during the flood, intense volcanism occurred as the fountains of the Great Deep broke open, depositing huge quantities of volcanic ash. This became intermingled with other flood sediments to form a variety of rock types. Chris, I think the flood of Noah's day is a very important concept which we must understand if we ever hope to understand the world around us. Let's develop a Back to Genesis way of thinking.
Thanks for tuning in to Back to Genesis.
listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. Chris Katulka, our guest today, Assistant Director of North American Ministries at the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, and celebrating Israel's 75th birthday. Celebrations taking place in the land yesterday, and of course, we'll be here for days to come. And certainly moving forward, a very significant milestone in this nation. And Chris is recounting the days, the events, the people, the places that were engaged in the development of the launch of this new nation. And so, Chris, you told us you covered a lot of ground here, taking us from 135 A.D., banishing the Jewish people, and then taking us to the late 1800s here with Theodore Herzl, who, as you called, the father of modern Zionism, and creating this First Zionist Congress, and putting out that belief that Israel would become a nation, and gave that figure of 50 years. And wow, it's amazing to see what's unfolded.
It really is amazing to see how the heart was there for the Jewish people to help to reestablish a state. Mm-hmm. But there was a problem. The big problem was the fact that the Ottoman Turks controlled that area of Israel. It was all under the control of the Ottoman Empire. And so what ends up happening is World War I changes everything, Jim. World War I will redefine the Middle East completely, not just Israel, but it will redefine how Europe will move its way into the Middle East. And England in 1917 will actually take control. The British Empire will take control of in 1917 of what would become called the British Mandate or British Palestine. And Jewish people were already living in that area by 1917. But what's really amazing is that in 1917, a very important document was signed by Lord Arthur Balfour. It's called the Balfour Declaration, where the British government promises to help the Jewish people reestablish a state. This is one of the foundational documents of the Jewish people looking to reestablish a state. And Jim, I'd like to add this too, because this is so important for our listeners to hear. The Jewish people were not looking to simply walk into the Ottoman Empire and to conquer that area and take it over, mm-hmm. and say, this is our ancient homeland, get out of here. If you notice, they were working to try to win the sympathy of the nations around them. By forming the First Zionist Congress, Theodore Herzl and his delegation were working to try to convince the German Kaisers and the sultans of the Ottoman Empire to allow them to have Jewish people return to that land and to almost lease the land out to them. They were trying to win sympathy. They weren't just trying to go in, conquer land, take it over, and kick people out, as many people try to call the Jewish people colonizers in the Middle East. They're not. They were actually given permission to do that.
Even occupiers.
Exactly. They're called occupiers. But look, going way back to Theodore Herzl, they formed these groups in order to win the sympathies of the nations. And in 1917, they got a big, big boost when the British government vowed to help establish a Jewish state through the Balfour Declaration, a very important document for the Jewish people in 1917. The problem, though, will be what happens between 1917 and 1947, because the British begin to change their minds a little bit as to their... The Balfour Declaration never loses its power, but the people in the governments of the British government in the parliament begin to change their sympathies toward the Jewish people because of the tension that begins to arise in the British Mandate in British Palestine. The Jewish people and the Arab Muslim community, they begin to go they're at odds with one another. More and more Jewish people are moving back to what was then British Palestine. And this raised concerns with the Arab community, and they started a lot of fighting was going on. A lot of murder was happening. Killing was going on. On both sides, it was happening, actually. It would be instigated by the Arab community, and then the Jewish people would retaliate. And eventually, the British started saying, I don't know if this was a good idea. And they stopped Jewish immigration, actually, into the Holy Land. They stopped Jewish immigration into British Palestine, which raised a lot of concerns, especially during the Holocaust, because you have Jewish people who want to leave the Europe. The United States isn't taking them. And where else would they go? Well, this is the whole point of what Theodore Herzl wanted. He wanted a state for his people to find protection. And they couldn't even travel to British Palestine. They were being turned away, Jim. They were being pushed back. They were actually being sent back to Europe. Imagine you leave Europe and then you get sent back to Europe, back to that to the prison camps, essentially the displaced persons camps. This created a lot of tension and a serious situation for the Jewish people between 1917 and 1947. But finally, in 1947, the UN signed what was called UN 181 or Resolution 181, which partitioned the land. It gave a land for a Palestinian state and a land for a Jewish state. That would become the impetus. It was actually the first two-state solution. Well, the Palestinians said no thank you, or the Arab community, the Arab Muslim community said no thank you. The Jewish community said we'll take it. And that is what would ultimately give way to a Jewish state, is UN Resolution 181. The nations decided that they would approve a Jewish state. So again, notice that the Jewish people did not come in and colonize. They bought the land even before it was a state for them. They were buying the land from the absentee landlords. They had worked the land. They had turned it into productive farmland. They made something of themselves in that land, and then the world, which I don't think has ever happened to any other nation in the world gave permission for the Jewish people to return. That can never be taken away from them. It's their deed. Not only is the Bible the deed for the Jewish people being back in the land, but the world signed an agreement saying the Jewish people deserve to be back in the land. You know, again, they were winning those sympathies.
Yeah, they were. And as you're talking about this and these moves to get there, you know, I go back to Micah chapter 4, verse 2. I mean, written more than 2,500 years before Israel became a nation, saying, "And many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths, for the law shall go forth of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." Written a long time before this, and the maneuvering that's going on to bring this about.
It's amazing that God was reorganizing the world again back to what he calls the center of the earth. You know, Ezekiel chapter 5, verse 5 says, God admits Jerusalem is the center of the world. And so God, again, is reorienting his position to let us know Jerusalem is still the center of the world. And think about it, Jim. Here we are, 75 years after the creation of the modern state of Israel, 2,000 years after Jesus' life, death, burial, resurrection, and ascension, even probably 2,500 years or more since Micah wrote that, and we are talking as non-Jewish people about the Jerusalem. And it's still a massive topic of conversation, so much so, Jim, that you know, when you think about the fact that Israel's trying to change some of their policies on their judiciary politically today, the Biden administration chimes in and says, "We're not inviting Netanyahu over here." So think about it. This tiny country, the size of New Jersey, can make the leading country of the West have an opinion about what they're doing in their country.
Amazing.
So much so that we're not going to invite him. So again, you can see how it becomes the topic of conversation on the front of newspapers around the world.
So get us up to David Ben-Gurion.
Yeah, David Ben-Gurion wept along with his other Jewish friends when Theodore Herzl died, but knew that they were Zionists, and they decided to immigrate from Eastern Europe over to British Palestine at that time. And it's really fascinating. His name is actually not David Ben-Gurion. That's not how he was born. It was David Grun. And so he changes his name to David Ben-Gurion, taking on a more Jewish name. And he becomes a very, very important leader for the Jewish people. As they are trying to figure out that the Jewish people, long before they became a state, had already set up the infrastructure for statehood. That's really important to see, that even though they didn't have statehood yet, they were already establishing a government that would ultimately rise up and become the government of the state of Israel. Those pieces The groundwork was already laid for that to happen. And David Ben-Gurion was very influential in establishing the major unions of the workers' unions for the Jewish people living in British Palestine at that time. It was called the Histadrut. He was very influential in developing what would become the government of the State of Israel. He was a real visionary, and that's why it was natural for him to become Israel's first prime minister. When he saw that the British were going to be leaving British Palestine, when they were going to exit, they had an exit strategy, he knew he had to declare independence the moment it happened. The problem, though, Jim, is that, of course, the British are leaving on Friday, and that's going to give us very little time to declare independence. They wanted to do it right away. They wanted to declare independence right away on May 14th, 1948, because they didn't want to give any time for any enemy to come in to try to destroy them before statehood. So they wanted to declare independence as fast as possible. So it had to be something that was done before sundown, because Sabbath was coming. And so this was a very big deal for the Jewish people. It's very fascinating, actually, when you study the history of the Day of Independence. David Ben-Gurion is going to host the event in a museum in Tel Aviv. But that museum was actually once the home of Mayor Dizengoff, who was the mayor of Tel Aviv, Tel Aviv's first mayor. And the mayor gave his home become a place for the city of Tel Aviv to have a museum. It was an art museum. But Ben-Gurion chose that place for a reason. Most of the first floor is underground. So in case an attack happened while they were declaring independence, they would be safe from an attack. So they chose that for that reason. But then it was also, Jim, supposed to be a very secret meeting. I love this about Israelis. It was supposed to be a very secret meeting. Only several, certain people were invited. They received an invitation, and the invitation even said, "Don't tell anybody." Well, guess what? There was a crowd of people outside as David Ben-Gurion was coming in. So they didn't do a good job hiding at all. On May 14th, 1948, the provisional government of the Jewish people at that time that was headed by David Ben-Gurion. You might even know some other names like Golda Meir. She was in the provisional government that was there. Her name is on the Declaration of Independence, and other very famous people. That when he stood up, he announced the Declaration of Independence. And as he's reading this declaration, Jim, it's amazing because he's going back even to biblical history, and he's going back even as a secular man. David Ben-Gurion was a pretty secular guy. He had some good insights into who God was, but he lived for the most part a secular life as a Jewish person. But he still chimed in on the Jewish history, on the history of his people that dates back to the Bible, and then runs the theme of the biblical history that they have here in the land and ties it right to the UN promise to return them, to give them a homeland. A very important day for the Jewish people.
Indeed. And friends, a quick break. We're going to take you back to that museum where this statement was made, and also the significant way that God used President Richard Nixon, used in a very special way in this story that's unfolding. Israel celebrating 75 years. Back in a minute on Crosstalk.
Relationships have been shattered due to lack of forgiveness. It's impacted marriages, parents and children, siblings, and even church families as a whole. Some have said that forgiveness is the most difficult commandment we are given as Christians. Why is that? Perhaps it is because it strikes at the core of our pride that says we deserve better than we are getting. Perhaps it seems if we forgive, we are letting that person win in a situation that hurts us in some way. In the book, Forgiven People Forgive, Pastor Jeff Miller shows us where the rubber meets the road. At the heart of why we should forgive is the fact that God has forgiven us and we are commanded to forgive. It's easy for bitterness to take root in a heart that is unforgiving. Forgiven People Forgive is available for a donation of $6 or more to VCY America. Call 1-800-729-9829. Ask for Forgiven People Forgive. 1-800-729-9829.
Chris Katulka with us here today from the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, talking about Israel's 75 years in existence here as a nation. And just going into the break, friends, I mentioned President Nixon did mean President Truman. We'll be talking about the significant way that God used President Truman here as it relates to Israel and what things were unfolding there at the Art Museum. Just before we do that, though, Chris, I know that your ministry produces a magazine called Israel My Glory, and you are one of the writers for Israel My Glory, and articles coming from a variety of authors, of many individuals involved with Friends of Israel Ministry. You are making available a complimentary one-year subscription to the magazine. Tell us about it.
Yeah, if your listeners are interested in learning more about Israel and the Jewish people from a biblical perspective, or maybe they're even just dipping their toe in right now for the first time and understanding the importance of Israel and the Jewish people biblically, I'd encourage them to get our one-year free subscription of our award-winning Christian magazine, Israel My Glory. I have a phone number, Jim, if I can share that with your
Please
listeners.
Please do.
Is that
sure.
All right?
Yes.
Okay, well, if your listeners call 1-800-257-7843. Again, that's 1-800-257-7843. If they've never subscribed to our magazine before, they can receive 6 free issues that will come to your door, or they can go to israelmyglory.org/subscribe, and they can either get, they can order it online, they can get a print version, or they can get a digital version, Jim, which will actually give them 40 years of Israel My Glory content right at their fingertips.
Wow.
So that's our Israel My Glory magazine.
Okay, so friends, you can call the toll-free number. Just say, I heard Chris Katulka on the radio, and I'm calling to get my free one-year subscription to the magazine. The number is 1-800-257-7843. 1-800-257-7843. Or go to israelmyglory.org/subscribe, and you'll be able to get that information there as well. Well, Chris, I'm anxious to hear just a little bit more of this story as it's unfolding, and I'm going to have you take us back to that art museum in Tel Aviv. There was a statement made by David Ben-Gurion, and a very significant statement that was made, and it was not long before there was trials already coming against this newfound nation.
Not even a few minutes goes by after David Ben-Gurion announces Israel's independence, right away they are attacked by Egypt in the south. They begin to move into Israel, and eventually not only will it be Egypt, but it will be Jordan. Saudi Arabia will have a part, Lebanon and Syria will begin to move in. They were outnumbered 10-1, Jim. In my book, Israel Always, I remind people all the time, the tiny Jewish state of Israel was even tinier than it is today. It was a sliver of land, actually. Today it is what it is because of what happened in 1967. But in 1948, it was a sliver of land. And you have to remember, too, most of the people that lived in Israel in 1948 were Holocaust survivors. A lot of them were Holocaust survivors. And so Israel immediately was under attack, outnumbered 10-1. And yet I really believe it was God's protection of his people as he was watching over them, that even though they were outnumbered 10-1, the Jewish people were able to push back their enemies over the course of the next year or so. And during the independence war, were actually able to establish boundaries, armistice lines that would keep them protected from their enemies between 1948 and 1967. And so Israel came under attack right away, surrounded by all of the nations around them. Iraq was even involved. That was another country I forgot to mention. But they were under attack, and it was something that would become a common theme for them leading up into the 1980s. That nations, instead of working independently, would work together. Arab nations, Muslim nations would work together to attack Israel, and yet they would never seem to get a foothold on them. In fact, Israel would be able to conquer them. Again, a picture of the fact that God even says, you know, God doesn't use Israel because they're mighty and great in number, and this is a great land, and these are great people. God uses them to shine his glory. And it certainly made people look and go, these people, something's going on over there, and we should keep an eye on it. We should see what's going on.
And God used President Truman in a special way. Tell us about that.
You know, as even though the world gave permission for the Jewish people to return, a lot of the nations didn't approve of it right away on an individual basis. And it was Truman's advisors who said, you should not approve this. Even though the UN approved it, you should not approve it as the president, because if you approve it and they become an independent state, well, they're going to be toppled right away. They knew war was imminent. The moment they declared, they knew the Jewish people would be in a state of war. I really believe the advisors were thinking about the Jewish people and the fact that war was imminent. But you know what? It was actually Harry Truman's biblical upbringing. He was raised on the Bible, and he talks about this. He takes the biblical learning that he had, and he actually felt like he was kind of almost like Cyrus the Great. And so without his advisor's approval, Harry Truman signs a recognition letter that he recognizes the state of Israel as the president of the United States, sends it off, and it becomes an official document. In fact, he did it so quickly, the original document has scribbles on it. He erased a few areas. He went back and corrected them. He didn't have time to make a clean document. So the original one actually has, you know, his handwriting on it and things of that nature, in order to just get this out as soon as possible. But he actually credits his biblical upbringing. Most presidents of the United States, after Truman, would actually credit their support for Israel and the Jewish people on the foundations that they had in a biblical upbringing, that they believed the Jewish people were important. And that even goes back to men like John Adams, our third president, who was able to stand up and say, you know, he believed that the Jewish people had a right to their own homeland. Going back even to our earliest history as Americans, it's really embedded because of the way that these presidents and these leaders in the United States believed what God was going to do with the Jewish people, and the way they were taught, I love this, Jim, the way they were taught in church about Israel really defined the way that they supported them later on in life as leading figures in American politics and American history.
Well, friends, there's so much more, but the clock says we're going to have to jump ahead here just a little bit into Israel's history, because not only was Israel immediately attacked and people really coming from the Holocaust had to start defending Israel right away, but we know that there are other significant times that Israel has faced war. And, Chris, you mentioned 1967. Tell us what unfolded.
Yeah, 1967 was a big year. You know, what happens is between 1948 and 1949, with the War of Independence, the Arab nations surrounding Israel, they got a big wake-up call. They thought it would be easy-peasy for them to just push the Jewish people into the Mediterranean Sea and retake the land. But that's not what happened. So they regrouped, actually. And when they regrouped, they opted to once again move and to try to push the Jewish people into the sea. This would end up becoming what's called the Six-Day War. In fact, we're going to have a specialist on pretty soon on one of our programs called FOI Equip, Dr. Mordecai Kadar, an Israeli professor from Bar-Ilan University, to talk more about the Six-Day War. He's a specialist in Arabic studies. But, you know, the real important thing here is that the Jewish people actually, the State of Israel, got a tip as to what was going on. They saw that war was imminent as well. But this time they decided to, instead of being just in the posture of defense, they decided to go into the offense. And they started attacking. Even as the tanks were lined up on the Egyptian border, they knew it was coming, but they attacked in a preemptive attack, which really saved them in many ways. They were still outnumbered 10-1, but yet instead of them just now controlling a small sliver of land, Israel took the Sinai Peninsula. They took the Gaza Strip. They were able to take the West Bank, which was controlled by the Jordanians, and then they were able to take the Golan Heights that was controlled by the Syrians. The Golan Heights remains a buffer zone between Syria and Israel today. It's under the sovereignty of the State of Israel. They returned the Sinai Peninsula to Egypt for peace, and they were able to hold on to the Gaza Strip until about 2005 when they turned it over to the Palestinians. And the West Bank, the Jordanians did not want the West Bank back. The king of Jordan, Abdullah, did not want the West Bank back. He wanted to establish a Palestinian state there, but the problem was the fact that the Palestinians have remained unwilling to create a state with the leadership of Israel. It's been offered to them several times since 1967, but they are unwilling to agree on the terms to create a state for the Palestinian people. So it remains, much of it remains under the control of the Israelis. Sections of it today are under the control of the Palestinian Authority. Cities like Bethlehem, Jericho, and Hebron, Ramallah, these all are big cities that are under the control of the Palestinian Authority. And so all of that stems, though, from 1967. The conversations we have about Israel today, a lot of it stems from what happened in 1967 and the Six-Day War.
Friends, you're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. Our phone number today, if you have a question you'd like to ask of our guest today, Chris Katulka, our number is 800-733-9829, 800-733-9829. Now, Chris, we could talk a whole lot more. There's been so many other events that have happened, and the anger against Israel, the rage, the continued terrorism, even this early this week leading up to Memorial Day as well. But explain for us, why is there such antagonism? Why is there such anger and hatred against Israel?
You know, it really stems back to what the Quran teaches about the Jewish people. It really doesn't have anything to do with the fact that the Jewish people are in the land. It's a beautiful thing that God has returned the Jewish people to their ancient homeland. But for the vast majority of the Muslim community, we're talking about the fact that they are raised to hate the state of Israel. It really comes from the way that they're raised in their culture, and then also what they learn from going to their mosque or being taught from the Quran. All of these things are ultimately going to determine why these nations have a hatred toward the Jewish people and the state of Israel. I'll just give you an example. An Egyptian young man was given a scholarship to study at a university. I believe it was Tel Aviv University. And he was the valedictorian. And so he was able to give the speech upon graduation. And he got up and he said, you know, I was raised to hate the state of Israel. I was raised. I listened to songs on the radio about the hate of the state of hating the state of Israel. I heard it at the dinner table. I heard it in school. I heard it all of my life. And I got this scholarship and I came here, and I don't understand why my people hate you so much. I don't understand where the hatred comes from. He says, you're beautiful people and you have a beautiful country. And I don't understand why we're so far apart, even though we're neighbors. And that comes from, Jim, that comes from a country where Israel has peace with Egypt. And so again, imagine that throughout the Middle East, and even in Europe and America as well.
Friends, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back to your phone calls here on Crosstalk and take your questions here for our guest today, Chris Katulka, Assistant Director of North American Ministries at the Friends of Israel. And we'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. Our website is worldviewreport.com. There's an organization I recently found out about entitled Better Than Cash. BetterThanCash.org is their website. And when you go there, you'll find out it's many governments of the world, along with big corporations. And according to the website, that includes, well, Target, along with Coca-Cola and others. And what's their goal? Well, according to their website and a speech given by the lady that runs the organization, it is to go to a cashless society, digitized cash. And what does she say is the purpose? Well, in the speech that I played on the radio the other day, she states it's so they can accomplish the Agenda 21, Agenda 2030 United Nations goals. That's radical environmentalism, end of private property, depopulation, and so much more. And guess where this organization is based? the United Nations. I'm Brennan House.
You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. Chris Katulke is our guest today from Friends of Israel, and they do have a magazine called Israel My Glory, and offering a free one-year subscription if you've never subscribed before to the magazine. You can reach out to them at 1-800-257-7843. That's 1-800-257-7843, or go to the website israelmyglory.org/subscribe. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Douglas calling in from Ringgold, Georgia. Hi, Douglas. You're on the
air. Yes. I want to make a comment about the Yom Kippur War and Golda Meir. She made a trip to talk to President Nixon. He talked to his mama. She said, now you can help the Jew. My neighbor was over in Germany in 72. President Nixon ordered every available plane to resupply them. They had them resupplied in 4 hours and fighting again. Sir, that's nothing but a miracle.
Hey, thank you, Douglas. And I mentioned President Nixon earlier, but go ahead and comment on President Nixon. This is a very significant aspect as well.
Yeah, Nixon played a very important role in supporting Golda Meir and supporting the State of Israel. And I kind of say this, 1973 was the opposite of what happened in 1967. Israel would actually receive a lot of backlash for taking a preemptive strike in the Six-Day War in 1967. Golda Meir knew that war was coming again in 1973, as the caller had said. She knew it was coming, and what ends up happening is that she says, I don't want to face that backlash again. So instead of doing a preemptive strike, knowing that war is coming, she did nothing. And so it really is a miracle, you know, Nixon came to her aid, Nixon came to her side, and Israel actually almost lost the North and other areas as well during 1973. If you ever get a chance to come to Israel with me, with the Friends of Israel, we always make it a purpose to stop up north to see the border between Syria and the State of Israel. We always make it a purpose to stop up there and even visit the Valley of Tears, where this amazing event took place, where Israel was outnumbered but was able to push back the Syrian army.
Let's go to Mark next in Monroe, Wisconsin. Mark, you're on the air.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's a major disconnect between the contemporary church and the nation of Israel. Sometimes I wonder if the North American church acknowledges that Jesus Christ, the Savior, is also the King of the Jews. So that's my comment.
Thank you, Mark. What do you think, Chris? Is there a disconnect between the church today in North America and the State of Israel?
What a great comment. What a great question. You know what? Israel and the church has never actually had a better relationship more than what I'm seeing today. I mean, churches are flocking to the Holy Land. There's a lot of participation between the church and the State of Israel. I see it firsthand. But I will also agree with the caller because what I see is that there are a lot of pastors and churches and even people in sitting in the pews that don't make the connection that Jesus was Jewish and the Messiah. A Messiah is the King of Israel. And they don't make that connection that God is doing something miraculous, as you called it earlier in the program, Jim. But, you know, that's North America. The evangelical church is no longer centralized in North America anymore. I think only 25% of global evangelicals are in North America. The other 75% are in South America and in the Asian continent, in China, all around the world. And I have to say something. I go to Israel with a group of other media, radio personalities, things of that nature, and Christian media, and they come from all over the world. I want to encourage your listeners that the United States might be going one direction, especially in the church, but I promise you there are Christians all around the world that are supporting the State of Israel. It's very encouraging to see.
We've got Tom next in Virginia, Minnesota. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, Jim and Chris, and thank you for your program here today. Very fascinating. A couple of comments. Just wanted to say that the Nation of Israel's rebirth is just an amazing confirmation of God's promises and his prophecy found in the Bible. And the second comment is just the wars are amazing how they were able to overcome their 10-to-1 odds. But the first war, my understanding is that they just had a very small hodgepodge component of weapons and weapon systems, and yet they were able to defeat their enemies. And that's all I have.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Indeed, the aspect of prophecy, Chris, from you know, Ezekiel, this valley of dry bones, the coming to life there, but then also just, you know, mentioning the other aspects pertaining to Israel as well.
Yeah, you know, I love what was just said about a hodgepodge of Jewish people fighting against their enemies and protecting themselves. You know, there was organization. They had known this was coming. It wasn't called the Israel Defense Forces just yet. It was called the Haganah Defense Forces, ultimately. But I encourage your listeners to look up online the story of the Ayalon Institute. That's A-Y-A-L-O-N, Ayalon Institute in Israel. It's the story of where Israel got all of its bullets, a majority of its bullets, to fight in this independence war. It's an amazing story, and I encourage them to look it up to learn more about it.
And I've seen stories here, Chris, though, about the Israeli Defense Forces. Some have described them as one of the most powerful militaries of the world.
Yeah, it's one of the most powerful militaries. It's also one of the most advanced militaries. Mm. You know, they are constantly under the pressure of attack, so they can never rest on their laurels or say, we just have to do it the way that we did it last time. They're constantly reinventing themselves. They're constantly rethinking about how to do military strategy. And I'll also say this, they function much, much differently than most military armies do. The guy on the bottom of the rung of the ladder in the IDF, his voice is just as loud as the guy at the top. And they listen to the people at the bottom because that is where you win a war. You don't just win it with a voice from the top, from your general or from your captain. Everybody's listening to one another, and Israelis are always up for sharing their thoughts about the way things should be. And so they listen, for the most part, to everybody in the military, and it really defines how that military functions like a family.
Israel celebrates 75 years, folks. It's a miraculous story. Chris Katulka with us here today from Friends of Israel. And again, their toll-free number to request the magazine, 800-257-7843. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jim.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.